It's the Sound of Ideas from 90.3 WCPN IdeaStream. I'm Dan Malthrop. Good morning. Thank you so much for joining us today. And today we're taking a look at the world of estate planning. That may sound like a rarefied place, but in many ways, it's coming to the masses. And regardless, we all have a stake in how other people's estates are planned. Consider this. With the year-long lapse of the federal estate tax, that's this year, 2010, no federal estate tax, the government revenue will be down roughly $25 billion in terms of taxes the government takes in. And that really, $25 billion, when you think about it, it's enough to bail out a small regional bank, perhaps, or fund a few significant stimulus projects. So we'll look at estate planning through the lens of two issues, this estate tax holiday and the increasingly common practice of Medicaid planning. That's what the industry refers to as shifting asset ownership so that family members can qualify for Medicaid. With me this morning in Studio 4 at the Idea Center, attorney Kevin Purcell. He's a specialist in estate planning. Good to see you, Kevin.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
And also joining us from the New York Times, Paul Sullivan, who writes the Wealth Matters column. He's with us by phone from his home in Connecticut. Paul, welcome to the Sound of Ideas.
Hi. Thanks for having me on today.
It's great to have you on. Let me say, too, that your questions about estate planning, about these, and in particular, these two areas of estate planning, which you could spend the entire day talking about if you wanted to, you're welcome to join us, 866-578-0903 or news at WCPN.org. You can also find us on Twitter at Sound of Ideas. You can find us on Facebook. That's facebook.com/Sound of Ideas. And you can also visit us on the web and leave comments there at WCPN.org/SOI. Paul Sullivan, this estate tax holiday, some people may not have noticed, although they may really have noticed over the last week when the business pages of the New York Times published a story about Dan Duncan, whose family gets to keep his gajillionaire fortune.
They're at least keeping $9 billion of that gajillion. That is true.
So tell us about with this estate tax holiday this year. The estate tax has lapsed. How did this happen exactly? It happened, I think, during the Christmas holidays last year when many people may not have been paying attention.
Yeah, essentially what happened is back in 2001, President Bush put through some tax cuts, and part of that was a revision to the estate tax. And it used to be, in 2001, it was $1 million exemption per person and a 55% rate after that. From 2001 to 2009, that exemption kept increasing and the rate kept lowering. So if you died at the end of December in 2009, one person would have had $3.5 million exempted and the rate would have been 45%. The one catch here, though, was all along there was this sunsetting of the law, which is what we're in now, in the year 2010. Practically speaking, though, nobody really imagined that Congress would let this lapse. They thought they would just renew it, and they'd either make permanent, depending on your point of view, make permanent the exemption in 2009 or abolish the estate tax altogether. Neither of those happened. What happened was Congress did nothing, and in doing nothing, we're in this estate tax holiday. And what makes it worse is next year, if Congress continues to do nothing, we go back to the old 2001 rules of $1 million exemption and a 55% rate above that.
$1 million exemption, which in 2010 or 2011 is not the same as $1 million exemption in 2001.
Yeah, and one of the problems here is, you know, obviously we're talking about people with a bit of money here, but the estate tax was always meant to catch people at the absolute highest level of wealth in America. And so today, you know, particularly where I live on the coast, you know, $1 million for one person at the end of his or her life is not really that high. You know, they bought their house 50 years ago, it's appreciated, they have a retirement portfolio, it's appreciated. And so one of the indignities of this could be is somebody dies, you know, with a $2 million estate next year, and they could end up paying, their heirs could end up paying, you know, $550,000 in estate tax, where the heirs of Dan Duncan get all $9 billion estate tax free.
That's really astounding. What do you think is likely to happen, Paul?
Who knows? If you had asked me this question this time last year, I would have said, well, Congress will never let the estate tax lapse. They'll you know, extend it. They'll make it permanent. They'll do something. And, of course, I don't think anybody in the estate tax planning world believed what has happened would happen, but it did happen. And so this year, I mean, there are two schools of thought. If nothing happens before July, when Congress goes into summer and then everyone has to rev up for re-election, we'll be lucky to get something done in November in a lame duck session of Congress. What's more likely to happen, my sources tell me, is that come January, February, there's going to be a scramble to do something to rectify this problem, because pretty soon, upper middle class people are going to wake up and say, wait a second, how come I'm paying the estate tax when a bunch of billionaires died in 2010 and they paid nothing?
Paul Sullivan is a writer for the New York Times. He writes the Wealth Matters column. Kevin Purcell, a local attorney specializing in estate planning. How has this anomaly changed your world over the last 6 months, the last year?
Well, for one thing, in the beginning of this year, it put us into panic mode because we had drafted hundreds and hundreds of trusts for married couples that had a very common provision in it, which would have sheltered the first to die's, it would have made use of the first to die spouse's applicable tax exemption so that it would not have been wasted. It's a common estate planning technique so that when the surviving spouse dies, she would have had the benefit of both of the exemptions. Now, we come in 2010, and as Mr. Sullivan said, nobody really expected that this would happen, that Congress would allow this problem to come to fruition in the year 2010. And so we have documents that say that the first, that whatever is equal to the applicable tax exemption goes into this particular trust, whatever is equal to the marital deduction goes into this particular trust. Well, there is no applicable tax exemption. There is no marital deduction. And so we had documents that literally were gobbledygook. This is a problem that was very common across the United States. And so we had to send out emergency letters to hundreds of clients and get them back in and restate, tweak their trust just for this year in the event that somebody died this year. And we've had a couple of administrations of people who have passed away. And it's a good thing that they were the ones that came forward and we did an amendment. So it really did cause a scramble.
In the midst of a recession, a full employment act for estate planners.
They always say change is good for lawyers and accountants. In this case, I hate to look at it that way, but no change was good. But again, it caught us all by surprise, like Mr. Sullivan had indicated.
Paul Sullivan, is there any chance that that there was some talk in the first half of the year, and I guess we're still in the first half of the year, but that the Congress might do some sort of provision and retroactively change the laws applying to this year, this 2010 year? Is there any chance that that would happen?
I mean, anything's possible, but it's at this point not highly likely, and that's for two reasons. One, Dan Duncan. I mean, if his heirs want to fight this, they can fight it. I mean, I don't know how he planned exactly, but, 45% rate, they're getting an extra $3 to $4 billion that they wouldn't have otherwise. That's a lot of money that his family can spend on attorneys to go after the IRS.
I should explain in a little more detail exactly, or ask you to explain in a little more detail who Dan Duncan was and why his case, that the case of his death and the inheritance that his heirs stand to gain is so significant.
Sure, he's a great American success story. He was, he started out with a couple trucks, $10,000, and built his fortune in the oil business. He was the richest man in Houston when he died, and very philanthropic, and like anybody else with that kind of wealth, he surely had a very extensive estate plan. The reason being, at that level, you know you're going to pay a lot in estate taxes, so you either want to minimize it or you want to direct as much as you can to the charities of your choice. So now, without that estate tax, his heirs really have this windfall. And Mr. Purcell can probably add in on this, but per the law, an estate can pay the fees that it needs to pay for, say, legal expenses out of the estate itself. So if you have this $9 billion pot of money and the IRS, and Congress passes a law making this retroactive and the IRS has to enforce it, the Duncan family can say, you know what? We've got this $9 billion pot of money. If we spend $1 billion fighting the U.S. government, that's down to $8 billion, and that's the amount on which the estate tax is going to be applied. So it's really a no-brainer for them to fight this.
And then, however that is determined in the courts, would then apply across the board.
You're absolutely right, Dan. It would take years and years and years. And that comes to the second point. A lot of people go back to what's called the Carlton case. This is a Supreme Court case back in the 90s. And essentially, it rose to the court in the 90s. It was about a similar situation that had happened in which the estate tax rate had decreased. And so it had gone down to 45, and then midway through the year, Congress had voted to increase the rate to the old level. And so it went from 45 to 55, and the Carltons brought a case, rose to the Supreme Court. They said this is unconstitutional. The Supreme Court said, well, actually it is, because you're just increasing the rate. The difference here is if they were to try to make a tax, Congress has tried to make an estate tax retroactive, they would actually be imposing a tax that doesn't exist right now. So it's not an increase on the rate. It's an imposition of a new tax. And this is where many of my sources say the debate will come.
And then it becomes a political thing, and something that nobody would want to do politically.
Yeah, not so much that. I mean, you could get a lot of political traction these days by saying we're going after these billionaires. But the harsh reality is, the IRS loses. They don't win every case they bring. And if they're going against a resolute family with billions of dollars to spend, that family can hire the best attorneys in the world and continue paying their hourly rate indefinitely.
Kevin Purcell.
Yeah, if I could just jump in for a second. I think Mr. Sullivan is correct. It's not really so much political. I would say there's really a constitutional issue there, a serious one about an ex post facto law and whether or not it would be constitutionally permissible to take a law that did not apply at the time that this gentleman died and retroactively enforce that law for he or anybody else, for that matter, that died in the year 2010.
Kevin Purcell, in the meantime, states such as Ohio, there are many states that have a state estate tax.
Correct.
Those taxes have not been suspended for the year.
That is correct. Ohio has the lowest applicable tax exemption of any state in the U.S. that has an estate tax. It's $338,000, and so
meaning if your income, your estate is valued at $338,000 or below, you pay no taxes. Above, you start paying taxes.
Exactly right. So the Ohio estate tax will snare many more Ohio citizens then certainly the federal estate tax will almost certainly, regardless of what they do with it. However, the rates are much more benign. They're 6% between that 338 and half a million, and then anything in excess of a half a million is, compared to 55%, only 7%. So it's kind of like a stick in the eye as opposed to a baseball bat over the head, but it's still a tax that we plan for and try to plan around when we're doing legitimate estate planning for our clients.
Kevin Purcell is a local estate planning attorney specializing in estate planning. Paul Sullivan is with the New York Times. He writes the Wealth Matters column. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, how you get around these estate taxes. There are some moral and ethical implications to those decisions as well. We'll touch on those. And also that conversation about how you get around these things, forming trusts and squirreling assets away where the government can't, where Uncle Sam can't see them, that is going to get us to this other part of aging and planning for aging, which is the Medicaid planning portion, which raises a whole other set of related ethical issues. Our phone number is 866-578-0903. Our email address, news@wcpn.org. You find us on Twitter, Facebook, and the web. I'm Dan Malthrop. We'll be right back. This is The Sound of Ideas. I'm Dan Malthrop. Good to have you with us at 22 minutes after the hour. We're talking today about two particular issues in the world of estate planning. One that we've been talking about, the strange estate tax holiday that's happening this year. And the next issue that we're going to get to is how people like Kevin Purcell and others who advise the very wealthy and increasingly just the somewhat wealthy and somewhat rich on how to structure their estate and plan their estate to avoid paying taxes and provide more for their heirs. Paul Sullivan is with us from the New York Times. And let's take a phone call right now. Jeff's joining us from Cleveland Heights. Hey, Jeff.
Hi, good morning, Dan.
Good morning. Go ahead.
What I'm really interested in is, I mean, was this a Homer Simpson moment in Congress? How in the world did they miss this?
A lot of forehead slapping, I'm sure, at some point in the halls of power there, Paul Sullivan. How exactly did they miss it?
The caller put it perfectly. Dope. I mean, what it was is, yeah, let's not forget, there's a big health care bill that everyone was working on at the end of last year.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
So that occupied a lot of time. And while I think our representatives are generally well-meaning and bright for the most part, they have priorities. And
you are being charitable, aren't you, Paul?
Wasn't a priority for them. Though there was an attempt to just extend it by 3 months, but that needed unanimous consent in the Senate to go through, and
that's impossible.
They don't always get along these days, and so they didn't get unanimous consent.
Kevin Purcell?
Yeah, I was just going to point out that both this tax law, which was enacted in 2001, as I believe was mentioned earlier, as well as the Health Care Reform Act that was enacted earlier this year, both were reconciliation acts. And, of course, we heard a lot of and were educated a lot about reconciliation in the media this year. This was also a reconciliation act, and it came about, in my view, because the Democrats and the Republicans are so polarized and probably just as badly or almost as badly in 2001 as they are now, that there was simply no way they could come to a compromise. So what they did is they had this graduated applicable exemption, and then they backloaded all the problems, figuring, well, by the time 2010 rolls around,
the economy will have grown so much.
Right. And we'll have time to fix it. Well, guess what? They haven't even had time to look at it because there's so much on the plate of Congress as well as the administration, of course.
Wow.
And so now we're left to deal with it. And all reconciliation acts have to sunset after 10 years.
Ah.
Yeah, and I agree with what Mr. Purcell said there. I mean, if you look at it from the extremes of the two parties, if you're on the extreme left of the Democratic Party, you want the lowest possible exemption and the highest tax rate for the wealthy. If you're on the extreme right of the Republican Party, you want no estate tax. And so with that came the problem. You know, why the Republicans were happy to let it expire, because we have this year now where there's no estate tax. Of course, this is where the problems come at the end of this year, because the exemption becomes so low and the rate so much higher in 2011.
Jeff, thank you so much for that call.
Thank you.
Bye. So, Kevin Purcell, moving then on to how you help people protect their assets from these sorts of taxes, and also from the other piece that we'll be getting to in a few moments. But what exactly do you do? What exists? What are the menu of options for people who are seeking to shelter their wealth from these kind of taxes?
Well, first of all, I'd like to emphasize, and I do this to my clients probably within the first 10 minutes of meeting my clients, which is to advise them that estate planning is not essentially about estate taxes. It may be, especially this year, it's not about estate taxes at all. And for the most part, it affects a minority of Americans. I think and we'll probably get into this as we talk about the Medicaid and nursing home issues that I think we'll be discussing. But I am a firm believer and a proponent that the essence of estate planning is asset protection. And so we'll say that.
So what does that mean exactly?
Well, it means that there are unique non-traditional ways in which you can own your property, or you have title to or ownership of your property, which actually is more advantageous than owning it outright. If I own my house, well, I certainly have the right to use my house and enjoy it, but I also have exposed it to what we call creditors and predators. If I hit the proverbial school bus and I have a huge judgment against me in excess of my policy limits for my automobile insurance, for example, my house obviously is at risk. If you own, it was John D. Rockefeller, once they asked him what was how did he become successful? He said, well, I learned how to control everything and own nothing. Now, I'm not suggesting that we do that with every single asset a person has, but by having ownerships in other means, the most common of which is a trust, which will allow the person who set up the trust access to those assets so they can enjoy them just as if they had not set up the asset. But because legally they don't have title to the asset, then, for example, the IRS is going to say upon that person's death, they really didn't own that. It's not in their taxable estate. And to extend the what I was saying earlier, and in a lawsuit type of situation or a divorce situation, it would be favorable to have the assets held in trust because, again, the person has complete use and enjoyment of those assets, but they're protected from these creditors and predators that you don't want to get their hands on your assets.
So you're talking about when you talk about these assets, I mean, you're talking, you've mentioned a house, you've mentioned, I assume, how do you put a house that you live in into a trust as if you don't live in it? Or, I mean, I'm a little confused about how that works exactly.
Well, it is a little bit confusing. And I should point out, having said what I just said, I don't want to mislead anybody and suggest that if you have a simple revocable living trust, and revocable living trusts are pretty common these days, that if I were to take my house and have a deed from Kevin Purcell to Kevin Purcell, trustee of the Kevin Purcell Trust, that that house is now safe from my creditors. In Ohio, that is what is called a self-settled trust because I set it up. And the laws in Ohio is that if you're the person who set up a revocable trust, then those assets are fully available to the IRS.
It would still be taxable.
Exactly,
still be,
right.
Still be available if there was a lien on you or something like
exactly.
that.
Exactly. But where it can become, asset protection can become very important is for your loved ones. You can't plan with a revocable trust to protect your assets from your creditors, but you could plan to protect them from your loved ones' creditors when you pass away. And what we typically do, with, instead of leaving them outright to my sons or what have you, I would leave them in trust for them where they'd have total access to them if they were old enough and we felt responsible enough. Or we could have a trustee that would be kind of the gatekeeper if they were of tender age. But it would certainly be set up in a way that your creditors, such as the IRS upon the death of my son or upon a lawsuit against him, those assets would be protected. So in a nutshell, with revocable trusts, and we're not talking about Medicaid just yet, with revocable trusts, you can't really protect your own assets, but you could do a lot of very creative planning to make sure that your assets don't end up, for example, with a former son-in-law or former daughter-in-law because you gave everything outright to your son, and 3 months later, he gets divorced and his spouse makes a claim that this is marital property and could arguably end up with half of those assets. And I'm sure that's not what my client had in mind.
Kevin Purcell, if you're just joining us, is a local attorney. He deals in estate planning. And Paul Sullivan is with us as well from the New York Times, writes the Wealth Matters column. Paul, these ideas that Kevin's talking about, it's my understanding that these have been the domain of the very, very wealthy for a long time, from decades and decades and decades. But now there are increasingly numbers in the middle class who are exploring these options.
Sure. I mean, I think trusts get a bad label. You think of trust fund kids. On the East Coast, we call them trustafarians. They're kind of living a loose life, fully funded by their parents. But, you know, Mr. Purcell makes a great point. I mean, a trust is nothing more than a legal structure. And before coming on the show today, I went through his website, and he does a good analogy there. He talks about boxes. And so if you could hold your house in your hand, that's you owning that house. But if you put that house in a box and you still pick it up, you're holding the house, but what you're really holding is the box. And that's a good way to think of trust. And, you know, he talks about revocable trust. The other part of that is an irrevocable trust, just what they say. You know, one you can say, I don't want to do this anymore, do over it. The other one, you can't. And I think it's very common, a lot of couples, I'm by no means among the super rich, but my wife and I have, you know, trust set up for our children. And essentially what it is, you know, it's the Paul Sullivan Trust, and if I die, you know, Laura is the beneficiary, and you know, vice versa. And so it's just a simple way, you know, not so much, you know, it has a shady connotation of I'm going to, you know, shield it from the government, from creditors. But, you know, as Mr. Purcell says, it's just a safe way to guard your assets and make sure they go to the people you really want them to go to, be it, you know, your wife or your children, and not to somebody such as, you know, as he said, you know, your son's soon-to-be ex-wife.
I get that, but isn't that what wills are for, Kevin Purcell?
Rarely do I see a will that does anything other than leave everything outright to the beneficiaries. And so certainly a will allow you to say to whom you want to leave your assets, and that will generally be honored in the probate court. However, you're leaving your assets outright to whoever your loved ones may be, and so they have no creditor protection or remarriage protection or divorce protection, all of these kinds of protections that we can build into these trusts. And the comment on Mr. Sullivan's point that this is really not to be considered something that which is sullied or shady. Oftentimes, I'm thinking to an interview I had yesterday morning with clients. The trust that they wanted to set up was not to protect their son, actually, in this case, it was their daughter, from outside influences. They wanted to protect their daughter from their daughter. She was of tender age, and they were concerned if they both ended up in they traveled together a lot, they both were to die, she would get this money at the age of 24, and they felt very strongly it probably would all be gone. And it was a sizable sum of money within 2 or 3 years. And so what we did is we set up a trustee other than the daughter, who would manage those funds until she reached a certain age or, in the judgment of the trustee, was exhibiting more responsible relationships with her money. And so these trusts oftentimes are used to protect the beneficiaries from their own indiscretions or their own improvidence.
And there's an aspect to this that's a little like controlling from beyond the grave, the parents who can't let go. But I suppose that's their right, and it is available to them through the laws of our great nation. Let's go now to Loretta, who's joining us from the Lee Harvard neighborhood in Cleveland. Hi, Loretta.
Oh, hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm fascinated with Mr. Purcell. I have no problem with anyone trying to protect any of their assets after they have paid their fair share of taxes. This getting out of paying your fair share of taxes is borderline criminal. I was laid off in 2005. I made less than $20,000 and I was audited. And for me to sit there in that office for 3 to 5 hours while someone is stashing millions in the Cayman Islands, it's not fair. And I just think that after the rich pay their fair share of taxes, then, you know, I think that they should be able to sit with you and to, you know, save or prepare however which they want. But this deficit that we're looking at, it's because the rich have not paid their fair share of taxes. If the rich use tax loopholes, tax shelters, offshore banking, blind trusts, this means they have never paid their fair share of taxes. And this is how this deficit is looking at us. And
Loretta, you raise some very important points. Certainly, Kevin Purcell, please.
Yeah, Loretta, I have a great deal of sympathy for the points that you made. First of all, let me say just from the beginning that I am not taking my clients' assets and putting them in the Cayman Islands. I would really like to have my law degree stay on my wall and not be taken away, because that would clearly be illegal. And I don't think any reputable estate planning attorney in the country would get involved in that. But where I think you make a really excellent point, and I think we'll probably be getting into this before the end of the show, is why is it that I am legally, as an attorney, able to do this planning for very wealthy people, and maybe have a $10 million client that comes through the door, and I'm able to save them $3 or $4 million. Now, The reason I do it, it's because it's the law. It would be unethical for me to say, well, you know, I'm going to substitute my judgment for the law and I'm not going to do this for you. So admittedly, yes, I do that kind of planning. But you raise a very good point, because if we get into Medicaid planning and we talk about somebody who's saved a nest egg, maybe they have $100,000 or $200,000. They've worked all their life for that. And we use this exact same kind of planning so that person or that couple can keep that nest egg that they've played by the rules and were able to successfully keep in their golden years. And because one of them is unlucky enough to come down with Alzheimer's and they have to go in a nursing home, they get completely wiped out. Now, we have the same strategies, and this is basically what my practice consists mostly of, to use these planning techniques using trusts that typically are used for the rich, for the middle class. And I get a lot of flack for that. And I think this is where you raise a great point. If the wealthy can do this, certainly people of very modest means should have these kinds of planning opportunities available for them. And I have a great deal of sympathy for the point that you make. And I think that's where I do see some hypocrisy, where people don't bat an eye when it's done for the wealthy. Although, since it is legal, that's my job as a lawyer. It's like if somebody came in and they're a criminal defense attorney, they have to represent that person. But I also don't think I should be criticized, or elder law lawyers should be criticized, for protecting the assets of middle class Americans who are trying to save their legacy, which may be $200,000. I think they have every right to use these same kind of strategies and not be criticized for it.
Loretta, thank you very much for the call. I think you put the conversation exactly where it needs to be right now. We have to take a short break. And when we come back, I want to pursue this about applying these very same tools to middle-class Americans of modest means for the purposes of protecting their assets so that an elderly family member can qualify for Medicaid. It's a very interesting area, and one that affects, of course, far more people than the estate tax holiday that some wealthy Americans are enjoying this year. This is The Sound of Ideas. If you'd like to join our conversation with Kevin Purcell and Paul Sullivan of the New York Times, please give us a call, 866-578-0903. There are lines available to you, 866-578-0903, or news@wcpn.org. You can find us on Twitter and Facebook and, of course, our website. I'm Dan Malthrop. We'll be right back. You're with The Sound of Ideas from 90.3. I'm Dan Malthrop. Coming up in the next hour on The Diane Rehm Show, reaction to the president's Oval Office address on the BP oil disaster. Plus, at 11, June marks the 50th anniversary of Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird. Stay with us in the 11 o'clock hour for a reader's review with Diane Rehm. Tomorrow in this hour on The Sound of Ideas, in the wake of the continuing BP oil gusher, we'll take a look at another form of drilling for fossil fuels, mining for natural gas. Underneath Ohio, Pennsylvania, New York, and West Virginia lie some 50 trillion cubic feet of natural gas, and energy companies would like the drilling to begin in earnest. But let's stop for a second and think about this. What exactly is the technology to do this? And given what's just happened with the technology in the Gulf, how dangerous is it? Does it put other natural resources, our groundwater, for instance, in any danger? We'll find out tomorrow morning here on 90.3. That conversation begins at 9 o'clock. Right now, we're talking about estate planning and getting into the area of using estate planning tools for the purposes of protecting assets so that elderly family members can qualify for Medicaid. Let me reintroduce our guests, too. Kevin Purcell is an estate planning attorney. Paul Sullivan writes the Wealth Matters column for the New York Times. And our phone number is 866-578-0903. And, Paul, a quick question about the trust that Kevin Purcell was outlining a few moments ago. Does a trust of these sorts completely protect these assets from taxes in the event of a death?
Well, it depends what you mean by completely protect. I mean, what Kevin was talking about earlier in the show was how the estate tax threw in disarray what's typically called formula clauses. So one spouse dies, a certain amount goes in the trust, vice versa. That's meant to essentially maximize your exemption level, the old one being $3.5 million per person, so $7 million per couple. That's the type of trust we're talking about here. There's something called Delaware trusts, which are much more esoteric, but they are, in theory at least, a true asset protection trust. You know, say you're a doctor and you're worried about a malpractice suit, you could put some money in a Delaware trust if it's there more than 4 years. it'd be protected from creditors. But when we're talking about taxes, I mean, the caller raised an interesting issue, and I get, you know, dozens of emails a week from people similar to the caller, and that's, you know, the argument here isn't, you know, so much taxes. These people at whatever level have been paying taxes all along, income tax, sales tax, property tax, capital gains tax when they sell securities. This, what we're talking about here with trust is to sort of maximize what you can get under the law. I mean, that is the key here. And the second thing, what Kevin said, is that, you know, when we're talking about estate planning, we're trying to make sure we're protecting what people have. And at the most basic level, if, you know, you want to give your golf clubs to one grandson and not to your son, you could lay that out in a will. And so this isn't about money in that sense. It's about what somebody's wishes are. And that's how the whole, that's how I frame the discussion about trust.
Okay. Now, Kevin Purcell, moving along to the issue that you brought us to and that Loretta calling from Cleveland brought us to, using these trusts to protect assets for Medicaid planning purposes, i.e. to basically move everything that you owned as an asset to somebody else or to some other vehicle so that you qualify for Medicaid. And the threshold for qualifying for Medicaid is quite low. You have to be virtually destitute.
$1,500
in assets.
The most you can have.
Plus, presumably, some sort of income in terms of Social Security or something like that is permissible.
Yes, but if you're in a nursing home, all but a very small deductible for personal allowance and maybe the insurance payments you're making would all have to go to the nursing home from your Social Security. So they keep you at that $1,500 threshold or lower in order for you to continue receiving Medicaid benefits.
So let me ask the ethical question that's at the heart of this. I mean, is that really, if somebody has $100,000 in assets or $200,000 in assets, is it really ethical to move that money elsewhere so that it's not used for that person's care and that instead the taxpayers pick up the bill? Is that ethical?
My answer is absolutely yes. Let me also put a proviso in there that not all of the planning techniques have to do with the transfer of assets. Although, to get to the heart of your answer, if you read the Deficit Reduction Act, which was passed in February of 2006, which is really the congressional mandate that directs this Medicaid program, along with all of the regulations that every state has put out. And Ohio has about 500 pages of regulations dealing with Medicaid and nursing home care. They all talk about Medicaid qualifying trust. It's not that we've figured out some serpentine way to get around the laws. All you have to do is read them. And if you set up the trust properly and administer it properly, those transfers to the trust, just by the laws that Congress has set up and the states are administering, are perfectly legal. And there's also other ways that we can qualify somebody for Medicaid, which wouldn't actually necessarily involve the transfer of assets. And that's, for example, an immediate pay annuity. It's right in the Congressional Act.
So what does that look like exactly? So the hypothetical couple that you raised before with $200,000 in assets?
Well, I could give you like one example, and it might take me a couple minutes, but it I think could illustrate the point of how a typical plan would work. Let's say we have a husband and wife, and I'm just going to give you a little bit of law here so that this makes sense. If the husband goes into the nursing home, the resources of both couple, both the husband and the wife, are counted for the purposes of determining whether he will be eligible for Medicaid or not. However, only his income can be forced to be used for his care. Her income is exempt or is not obligated to be used for his care.
But their shared assets can be used.
Absolutely, and must be used. And so let's say that she has an IRA that is worth, say, $150,000, whatever, you know, her financial advisor told her to put in it. And we have $110,000 of other maybe certificates of deposits that they've accumulated over the course of their lives, and one other asset, their house, which may be worth $150,000, and they have it completely paid off. And they came to me a real quick encapsulated idea of a plan that I would suggest for them would be, number one, she should take the IRA and do what Congress says she can do to it to make it no longer a resource, which is to buy an immediate pay annuity. And the Congressional Act, as well as the Ohio regulations, which has to follow that act, state that now what she's done is taken a resource which was in her name, and she's converted into an income stream. And because it's her income, now it cannot be used for the husband's institutional care. Secondly, I would suggest if they have $110,000, which is – I use that figure. I kind of cook the books on that because that's the most that a spouse who's living at home while her husband's in a nursing home can keep. I would say to her to go out and borrow against the house another $110,000 and then apply for Medicaid, because the rules are Medicaid will say that you can keep half of your assets, half of your resources, not to exceed $110,000. So what did I just do? I just inflated her the family's assets to $220,000. So they're going to say, you're going to have to spend down $110,000 at the Medicaid hearing, so she'll be disallowed. So she pays the debt back. She has, and now she's been able to keep the entire $110,000 that they had earned through their lifetime. Otherwise, they would have been penalized and would have been left with only $55,000. Now, I don't think I've used a trust or made any kind of transfers, but through these strategies, I've saved them the $150,000 in their IRA, and they've also saved them the full $110,000 that they started out with without them having to sacrifice $55,000 of money that they had earned and accumulated all of their lives.
And you've turned their house from an asset to a liability without actually changing very much in terms of the family's financial picture.
Correct, because we would pay the debt off fairly soon after we did the Medicaid application. And then we go back and apply again, and Medicaid would say they successfully spent down the $110,000.
Paul Sullivan, if somebody has an ethical problem with the scenario that Kevin Purcell just described, should they just get over it and say, hey, this is the law?
I'm not as familiar with the Medicaid issue as Mr. Purcell is, but I was listening very closely. And, you know, it all seems to make sense to me. And this is, of course, you know, the rub. I mean, if it's the law, it's the law. I mean,
the ethics don't matter.
Yeah. I mean, it's not unethical would be if, you know, he was cooking the books. And it's clear from his example that he's not. He's doing everything, you know, within, you know, the letter, if not necessarily the intent of the law. And there's nothing unethical about that.
Absolutely fascinating. Kevin Purcell, how many clients are you working with in those sorts of scenarios, middle-class clients with a modest amount of assets who are facing this Medicaid challenge?
That is the majority of my practice, actually.
Well, I would ask one question, Kevin. I mean, how much would it cost a client to have this done?
Typically, I suppose lawyers, you know, charge all over the map, and I think they generally charge based on their skill and ability. At least I would hope that they are. I typically charge 1 month in a nursing home, and most clients find that that is a pretty good deal because we're leveraging 1 month against all the months that they would be paying, which would result in them losing that 1 month plus all the other months anyway.
And so, nursing homes these days cost roughly $90,000 a year, $100,000 a year?
Well, what I use is what the Ohio Department of Job and Family Services says is the average monthly private pay, which is $6,023.
A month.
Yeah, it's a little bit – Cuyahoga County is a little bit higher than that, but I use the Ohio Department of Job and Family Services figure.
And I guess my other question for you, Mr. Purcell, would be this, and that if, you know, with this example, you know, husband and wife, they come to you at the point when the wife has realized that her husband has Alzheimer's and needs to go to a nursing home very soon. So how quickly can this all happen so that, you know, if he's put in an a nursing home in a 10-month lapses, and most of that money's gone anyway. Can it happen very quickly?
Actually, that's a great question. And fortunately, in Ohio, we have a Franklin County, which is the where Columbus is located. Columbus is the city seat of Franklin County, a Court of Appeals case, which states that so long as the community spouse, in this case the wife who is at home, does it before the Medicaid application, even if the institutional spouse is institutionalized, then it's okay. If you did it after the Medicaid application, it wouldn't help the family in any way.
So there is
but
a very clear order.
The Medicaid application, then that other spouse would have to be paying the nursing home care out of her pocket, correct?
Repeat the question. I'm sorry.
Before the Medicaid application, then the spouse who's not in the nursing home would have to be paying that monthly bill for her, you know, for the husband with Alzheimer's who's in the nursing home, correct?
That's correct.
Right.
And do you see this happening with extended family members as well, that grandma is widowed and is facing this challenge, and the family, you know, doesn't want to see, you know, the family, the extended family, each of the members of which all have families of their own, children of their own, and college tuitions, don't want to see their assets disappear with that $6,000 a month bill?
That is an excellent question, because oftentimes the phone call will come from a family member. And as an attorney, I have to be very clear, not only in my own mind, but communicate to my clients, which I do in writing, who is the client. And typically in that situation, I will meet with the with mom privately and spend some considerable time really exploring, first of all, whether she's competent, because if she's not competent, we can't do this planning. And secondly, whether this is truly what she wants, because if I'm doing it because the kids are worried about their inheritance and she's my client, I have a conflict of interest. So I have to make absolutely certain that she is competent and it's her desire. I've worked all my life for this money. I don't want to see it go to a nursing home. That's going to break my heart. I want to see that this legacy, that's her legacy, it may be $200,000, maybe $100,000, ends up going to my children. And if I'm satisfied that this is what mom really wants, then I'm comfortable in doing the planning.
When's the best time to start thinking about this?
When you don't need it. Because if you do it before you're knocking on the nursing home door or trying to get in, then we have a much greater chance of saving the family much more money. And in some cases, because of the 5-year look back rule,
we're about out of time.
Yeah. I don't want to get into too much detail, but if you do it when you don't need it,
the government can go back and look 5 years prior.
But only 5 years.
But only
right.
5 years.
So if you had a client they're in their mid-70s and they're otherwise healthy and they want to do this planning and they come at that time.
That's a good time.
They do the planning and 5 years goes by, they've saved 100% of their assets.
Absolutely fascinating. Kevin Purcell is a local estate planning attorney. Paul Sullivan with the New York Times. Thank you both so much. There's a lot of nuances we didn't get to, but I think we covered quite a lot of ground and covered it very well. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks very much for having me on.
It's been a pleasure. If you'd like to get the last word on estate planning or have some suggestions about other avenues we might cover in the future, there are plenty of ways you can do that. Leave a comment on our website, wcpn.org/SOI, or leave it on our Facebook page, facebook.com/soundofideas, or leave us voicemail, 216-916-NEWS.